Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Matthew Check. Matthew is a Cincinnati-based author and musician whose creative path led him from the bluegrass stages to the pages of his debut memoir. What began as a casual online writing class in 2014 grew into What Would Philip Roth Do?, a funny and deeply honest exploration of love, Jewish identity, and self-discovery in New York City. Written in bursts during lunch breaks and shaped with the help of an editor in Bolivia, the book features imagined conversations with Philip Roth, who serves as a sardonic voice in Matt's head as he navigates disastrous dates, cultural guilt, and the search for meaning. His work has been recognized in Billboard, Pop Matters, Americana UK, and The New Yorker. Matthew, with that, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today.
Dave, thanks so much for having me here. I'm really excited to talk to you.
And I'm really excited to talk to you and find out more about who Philip Roth really is. The only thing I could think of when I was reading your bios, there must have been some really interesting conversations you had during the writing of your book.
In my head with him? Yes. Yeah, they were fun. It's a shame they weren't with the actual Philip Roth, but yes. Yeah, it was fun to talk to the fake him. Yes.
Yeah, that's, and I'm interested. Go ahead.
I was about to say, as so many white male Jewish men have, as they've read his books over the past 50 years. You know.
Yeah, well, so. Philip Roth is somebody I am going to have to get familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, some of his work by this point is a little bit dated. And it's interesting, people that are even a little bit younger than me have not read him. And even myself, I knew who he was, but I didn't really read him until I was in my 30s, to be honest. I'm 44, and then I really read most of his books. I want to say like 20 of his books I read in the course of 5 or 6 years. I just, one after the other. And they're so different. His early work is really intense, very bawdy, sexual, even like profane, like really irreverent, you know, but also like sincere and authentic. And his later stuff is beautiful and like a very different writer. Like, I think one of his most famous books, you know, in his later years was The Plot Against America, which also became a TV show on HBO, right? So he was a very different writer when he got older, but his early work, I love and I really identified with. And, you know, that's why he's the guy I spoke to in my book.
So. Well, and it makes sense. And the thing that I like about him already is that as he grew older, his writing evolved, his creative muse evolved. I like that with some of the musicians that I like. They don't just stay typecast in one particular type of sound. They will evolve as they get older. They'll experiment. And I think just as a matter of personal growth, you know, our interests kind of grow as well, too, and they evolve.
We could go into some depth about what I did notice about his writing as I would read earlier and later stuff, that there were some thematics that remained with him that were salient throughout his life. And that type of stuff, there was something about it that resonated with me. I really felt like I was reading an uncle I had never met.
Yeah.
That kind of grew up in the same generation as my grandmother. And the absurdity of his life and the way that he wrote about his life, there was just something about it that was very Jewish. It was very East Coast. I had to just admit to myself, fine, it's very stereotypical, but I'm just right there with him. Like, I really can see myself in these situations, you know, or I could see like a family member having done something ridiculously stupid like his characters do. And so when it came time for me to sit down and really start writing the story that became What Would Philip Roth Do, I had to just admit to myself, like, wow, these situations I had found myself in as like a Jewish male in New York City and all the escapades I was on, they were very Philip Rothy. There was just no way around it. And in earlier versions of the memoir, there were other male characters that I tried to tell the story to, also the imaginary characters, you know, somebody to bounce my story off of for comic relief, so to speak. You know, like the earliest one was Ira Glass, very different type of personality, this American Life. Another one was Garrison Keillor from A Prairie Home Companion, who had an amazing show on NPR for like 30 years. And, you know, it was bluegrass and Americana, a lot of like that kind of that classic radio variety show. And he unfortunately had the a Me Too scandal, like 2017 or 18. And so I had to take him out of the book. And then after Philip Roth died, which was in 2018, I believe, I had a chance to publish part of the book. It didn't end up working out, but I had the idea. It's actually my wife's idea. Today is my wedding anniversary, by the way.
Well, congratulations. 2 years.
Thank you. Yeah, 2 years. Yeah, and they're great. We love each other so much. And it was her idea, believe it or not, to call it What Would Philip Roth Do? She's like, you should have the conversation with Philip Roth. Like, he's your favorite writer. Like, you know, why not him? And I'm like, you know what? That's like a great idea. And as I kind of started to rewrite the book with him being the imagined person I'm talking to, it became really organic, and all of these like scenes would come out from like his books. And I started to talk to him about the scenes in his books and things like that. And for me, it was really fun to revisit and rewrite those parts of the book so many years after having finished it, interestingly enough. So,
yeah. And I think sometimes circumstances dictate that the novel or book that we intend to publish isn't the book that we end up publishing. And I think as long as we remain aware to the fact that things are always fluid and that there's other pieces that can present itself to us that can make our work even fresher, why not? I mean, I think creativity is kind of goes on a continuum anyway. It's always a work in progress. Speaking of your book, let's talk. Today is October 14th, and we are recording on the 14th. And today is the book that the day your book has been officially released. Am I correct?
That's right. Today it's here. It is, and really excited. A couple of purchases already, and having a book launch event on Friday night here in Cincinnati. I'm really excited about that. Actually, across the bridge in Newport, Kentucky. It's going to be really fun. It's going to be a little musical reading, so to speak, about the music in the book. And we'll read some spots. It's not just about Philip Roth. It's also about my life as a bluegrass musician and a songwriter in my earlier years. I'm 44, but most of the book takes place from when I discovered the banjo at 18 years old, basically up until about 29 or 30. And I moved to New York and I'm a songwriter and I'm playing bluegrass in bars. And it's a lot about my origin story as an adult and as a Jew and as a musician. So yeah, I'm really excited for it to finally be out in the world.
Are there any other influences from your life that kind of shaped the book, in addition to your passion as to be a bluegrass banjo musician, or any other experiences from your life that readers will find in your book?
John, that's a really good question. There's so many influences in the book. I think that humor is a really big part of the book, and a very particular type of humor. It really is the Jewish self-deprecating type of humor through storytelling, I think. And I think my family is a family of humor and storytelling. I think humor also masks, it can mask things that you're a little bit afraid of talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for me, it allows me to kind of tell authentically parts of my life that I don't really know if there's an easier way to talk about failure and pain and things not working out and addiction. I'm sober, so it's a little bit about the years when I was a drinker. It's in the years before my recovery, so it's a little bit about that as well. But to get back to your question, I think that I really want to, you know, give honor to my family. There's a fly in the room. My family, who really, they're great. They're all great storytellers and through humor. I really can remember growing up being around a dinner table and my grandmother, my Bubby, telling a story. And the way she, even until she had undiagnosed dementia or Alzheimer's, I don't know, something. She really did not have a memory when she died. But up until her early 80s, she could still tell a great story. You were right there with her. Like, you were right there. And she would have these witty one-liners. And to be honest with you, like, she would say things that you're like, wow, Bubby, you can't say that out loud, right? She was like that, right? And for her generation, she was born in 1930. Like, people were really buttoned up in her generation. They didn't really let go like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when I read Philip Roth, it, ironically, the voice like made me think of my grandmother, who I know she never really read him. I'm like, were they friends in high school? Like, oh my God, like, really had that edge. She had that edge. And so I want to credit this humor, the really biting and judgmental with love Jewish humor of my heritage that really influences how this book was written. Yeah.
Well, I think humor is a great medicine for just about anything, you know, to get us through life's toughest moments, just to teach us that, to take ourselves as seriously as we do sometimes. And I think storytelling is just a great way to pass down cultural history. It's a great way to get an understanding of a person's life path. You know, I tell my students at Utica University and Pratt Munson School of Art, I tell them, sit down with somebody who's like 80 years old. They have 8 decades of stories that they can tell you. And don't think you're too young they're too old to teach you anything, and don't think you're too young to teach them anything. It's just like, sit down with an older individual. It'll be probably one of the richest experiences that you'll have in your life. And I like humor. It's gotten me through a lot of tough moments. And when I do humor in the classroom, it's always self-deprecating, never at the expense of a student, never at the expense of their self-esteem. And I just think it's a great tool. So if humor is one of the common denominators through all of the stories in your book, that's going to be an interesting read. It'll be something I'll be interested in getting my hands on. So
good. Yeah. It helped me kind of get through the book. There is a fine line too, because sometimes, you know, in writing, you're trying to be, I'll say it as myself, I want to be an authentic and a sincere writer, and I want the reader to identify with what I'm going through. I think that's the most important piece. Because like, there's a lot of salacious stuff in the book. Like there are scenes where I lose my virginity, scenes with other girlfriends, right? And it was really difficult to write. In the beginning, I was afraid of writing those scenes because I wasn't trying to write pornography or erotica. I was trying to write about my life, you know, and my editor, Wendy, the one of Bolivia, who you mentioned, I want to give a shout out to Wendy Gale, and who now lives in Cusco, Peru, with her husband. And this book would not come into creation without her, because she gave me the courage. I was writing an early scene, and she was like, Matt, I just want to see you get laid. Put me inside your head. Show me what it was like. And it took a couple of drafts, but David, I got there, and it wasn't pornography. It was just me writing a scene. And you know, when you see a really good movie, like an indie film, and it's not cheesy, and you're right there with what's going on. Like, that's what it felt like to write those early scenes. And she gave me the courage to do it. When I would nail it, it would just give me, it would just get me even more excited to keep writing the book, right? And give me more courage to write it.
You know, physical intimacy is a part of our life. It's a part of our growth. It's a part of our spiritual growth in many ways. And it's a part of who we are. A lot of times in our society, and I tell my students that there are two things that people are hesitant to talk about. One is death and the other is sex. And it's that people are dying every day. And as far as I know, people are still having sex. So if it's happening, let's not ignore those topics. Let's just sit and have an honest conversation about it.
Yes.
And take the mystery out of it. So, I like books that are an honest representation of an individual story. Given what you've described with the scope of your book, had there not been anything about physical intimacy or sexual scenes or loss of virginity, which is one of the rites of passage that every guy goes through, I would have questioned that.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I guess you're right from that perspective. Those are the things that's part of growing up, right? Those are the things that a person experiences, you know? And because I want to add a little asterisk to that, because I really found myself in the most absurd of scenes with some of these early life experiences. Like Philip Roth found a way. His work was fiction. He wasn't a memoirist, but I wonder if they even created the term for him, autofiction. You really felt like it was him living his life. Like that's how good he was at writing about, like as if he really was experiencing. A lot of his early books, like they're written from the first person, right? And so I really just, like when Wendy, my editor, gave me the courage to put it down on paper, but reading Philip Roth was like, okay, there's this precedent. Like this, like another Jewish male, 50 years, you know, even like a decade before I was alive, was publishing books where he was writing about his life, you know, and being a Jew in America and dealing with anti-Semitism, which I haven't really dealt with in my life, to be honest, was something that Jews really grew up with in the 60s and the 70s, and the shadow of the Holocaust and quotas going to country clubs and universities. It was very palpable for people back then, you know? And so like the Jewish male anxiety about life in general is something that a lot of us as Jews, I don't know if I can say that, I'll say I as a Jew experience some of the, I inherit some of that way of thinking, so to speak. So I am like a generation or two removed from it, but I really identify with the way that a lot of that makes its way into his writing, and definitely with the relationships and sex and love, right? So yeah, that's how it manifests in my work, I suppose.
Well, like I said, it should make for an interesting read for anybody that chooses to pick up the book. So
I hope so.
Oh, I believe it will, just from what you're describing. And I think it'll be a impactful read and an eye-opening read. Let's talk a little bit about your musical journey as a bluegrass banjo musician and songwriter. First of all, out of all the instruments you could have picked, and I'm not saying this condescendingly, why the banjo? Why bluegrass as that genre? What spoke to you? And secondly, how has your journey as a musician influenced your writing for the book, your identity, and your personal growth? And finally, the last part of this question, how has your passion for music helped you navigate life's challenges?
Wow, these are great questions. Well, first of all, bluegrass, it was one of these, like, I was called to it things. Like I first heard bluegrass music. It was one time I was 17 and there was this bluegrass band that came to our high school and they were opening for an open mic night that we had, I think that's how I remember it. And there were these four guys on stage and they were playing all these classic bluegrass tunes. And I was like, that's what I want to do. Now I've been playing music since I was 10, 11, 12, by that point, we were all into, it was, you know, the 90s, we were into Fish and the Grateful Dead and classic rock. We were jammers and electric guitars. And I just couldn't believe that four guys on stage had no microphones and they were doing three-part harmonies and banging out all these amazing solos. And I'm like, that's what I want to do, right? I was like, that's it right there, you know? And, I actually bought the mandolin first. I was like, I want to be a mandolin player because it's kind of similar to guitar. But I never really took to it. I ended up playing the banjo. And really just those early years of playing the banjo, I just could not stop playing it. I would practice and practice. I talk about it in the book too. I say, you know, there was an exhausting despair in playing the banjo in the beginning, because playing the banjo involves your three fingers moving in sequence in different patterns, and to memorize those patterns and to make them move organically, it just takes a lot of work. It's like doing push-ups and sit-ups, right? And so it's really not the creative side of your brain. It's the side of your brain that's really regimented. If you have the discipline to sit down and do something over and over and over again for an insane amount of time. I probably can now learn the banjo at my age. So it was a time of my life. And I just loved it, you know, and the creative side of my brain, I really loved, you know, the harmonies and like the soloing and the simplicity of the chord structures and the chord progressions. And there was a mysteriousness in a lot of the lyrics, because a lot of it is about Appalachia. And you know, a big misnomer about bluegrass actually is that like a lot of it was written like in the country, but a lot of it was written in the city, ironically. But anyway, regardless, a lot of it is about like this kind of iconic America that isn't around anymore. And to me, that was very mysterious because I'm a Jew from Philadelphia, right? So there's a little bit of mystery in it, a little bit of like a romance for a country that isn't really around anymore that we all kind of miss, so to speak, right? So all of that together was this recipe for an 18-year-old just falling in love with a type of music. And it ended up really becoming my music. It was not in the beginning, but eventually, you know, because I played bluegrass banjo for 20 years before I moved on to, you know, I have different type. I play different types of music too. I know you were saying you're going to look at some of my music on Apple. I have records that are Americana. I have Jewish kids music. I always come back to bluegrass, but like I spent 5 years going back to the piano. I have like 4 or 5 albums on the piano now. So, not saying I'm great on the piano, but I did it. Mm-hmm. So, but bluegrass really is like part of like who Matt Cech is as a musician. And it really began at 17, 18, 19 years old.
Yeah. And I know we were talking during our introductory chat and we were talking about one of my favorite banjo artists, Bela Fleck, also, I think has a couple of bluegrass albums out as well too,
but he does.
But I'll tell you, is when I just thought the banjo was another instrument that I saw him play, and I said, holy cow, he was getting all types of, you know, just that, like you said, the simplicity of the chord progressions, but he was just getting all kinds of different sounds and effects out of the banjo, and it made me realize that it's a instrument that has a wide range of expression. It's right up there with you know, guitar, you know, the great guitarists who build in effects with their music. And it was like, wow, I had a whole new appreciation for the banjo, you know, watching him.
Yeah. So with regard to Bela and me, because I'm really kind of cryogenically frozen now with regard to new music, there are so many amazing banjo players and bluegrass bands nowadays, you know, and I really got into the banjo in the late 90s. This is apropos of Bela Fleck. I'm about to tell you something about him and me, if I could say it that way, which is that, you know, we discovered him through the Fleck tones, not bluegrass. What's so ironic is my father bought my brother a banjo because we liked the Fleck tones. My brother's 2 years younger than me, and he's a much more talented musician than I am. He can learn an instrument and then he moves on, right? So he like figured out one song from this Flecktones record and he's like, you know what? I don't want the banjo. And it kind of collected dust in our closet, right? And then I fall in love with bluegrass and I pick up the banjo and I start playing it. And in 2000 or 2001, there was a Flecktones record called, I think it's called Planet Bluegrass. And it was volume 2. And back then, not like today, you have to go to a music store and you could actually buy the tablature. So I bought the tablature for Bela Fleck's albums. I kind of mentioned this in the book, but I don't go into detail, which is that like I brought all of this with me to Madrid, my semester abroad. And I would sit on our balcony over this little cobblestone street, San Blas in Atocha. It's this neighborhood in Madrid. It's like a neighborhood you would never hear a banjo in because it's like, you know, Spain, right? And I would just pour over this Bela Fleck music and I would memorize the roll patterns. I would memorize the roll patterns and then I would play the CD. I would play along to the CD. And when Bela Fleck would disappear on the CD, I knew I was playing his music note for note. That's how intensive a study I had of Bela Fleck's music when I was younger. And a lot of the way that he plays bluegrass banjo really stays with me till this very day. There's a couple of things that I do when I'm like in the middle of soloing or I'm playing at a jam. I'm like, oh, I could just tell you that's from the Bela lick, so to speak. A lot of it is like now, like really been just, it's part of like how I play the banjo. I'm not even that great of a banjo player anymore. I barely play. But for many years, I was in like a wedding band in New York for 10 years and I was playing every weekend. There was a time in my life where, you know how much of a banjo player I was? I had really bad tendonitis for a year and a half and I couldn't get rid of it. Like, that's how much I played.
Yeah, so, that's a lot.
Yeah, I play a lot. You know, the sign of a real musician is recovery and injury. And I'm an alcoholic in sobriety and I've had to get like acupuncture. I've spent thousands of dollars on acupuncture in like the past 5 years on my arm. But anyway, back to Bela. So he was a very important banjo player to me when I was a young man. And, you know, his playing is inside of my essence as a musician. There's no way around it.
Yeah, like you, I discovered him with the Flecktones, you know, with Victor Wooten and Future Man, Victor's brother. And I was just sitting, marveling at how, and I think that now they got Jeff Coffin, I think he played sax for them, I think at one point. Now I think he's with Dave Matthews, or he was the last time I looked. But I was just watching with just my mouth agape, just thinking how four guys could get that much rich sound. And so many diverse sounds, and just the creativity was just off the charts for me. And I remember I saw them, I believe it was in Schenectady at Proctor Theater. I'd seen them about three or four times. And I remember Victor Wooten was the only bass player I ever gave a standing ovation to during a bass solo.
Wow. Nice.
And yeah, they're incredible. They're really,
there's nothing like them. And like I said, I'm kind of cryogenically frozen with music nowadays. But at the time, there was nobody like Bela because, he was a Juilliard kid. So he studied the banjo, he really, as opposed to, I think most civilians that become bluegrass banjo players and end up being in bands, they do it by watching people and by playing, because bluegrass is like being in a pickup basketball game. So Bela, what was novel about him, this is my opinion. I this is just how I think. He really brought an intellectual side and a scholarly side, almost like an academy side to studying the banjo that I don't really know if anybody else had done it by that point. You know what I mean? So he was playing classical music on the banjo. I don't know if anybody ever did that before, right? So, but that being said, there's some incredible bluegrass that he played when he was really young. He was in these really awesome bands. And I think he was in the Newgrass Revival, his early record drive. It's so incredible. It's just amazing bluegrass. So,
Well, it sounds like he was a major influence in terms of you picking up the banjo and obviously you've studied him quite extensively.
Yep. It's been decades, but yes, there was a time where I would literally memorize his stuff. It's all gone. I don't have it anymore, but I really did. Before YouTube, before you could I had to figure it out myself. Anyway, so that's Bela to me. And I believe there was another question you had, but it's escaped me by this point.
How's that journey as a musician? How's it influenced, your writing for the book, your identity, and personal growth?
Right. Well, somebody asked me this before, I'll answer it this way. Is being a banjo player or a musician, how has it helped you be a writer, or something like that? And to be honest with you, writing a book is nothing like writing a song, at least for me, because I'm a songwriter in the sense that I'm really inspired by something. I don't know where the song comes from. It just comes out of me. And I've always been that type of a songwriter. For my own self, if I have an assignment, I can write you a song. I've written songs for birthday parties. I've been asked to write songs for other types of situations. I was commissioned to write a song for a gala event for a synagogue, and I wrote the song. I got paid for it. Right? So I can write a song if you give me an assignment. But to write a song about my life, I need to be inspired. Yeah. And what's amazing to me is, and I write about this in the book, my origin story is I really was that stereotypical type of writer. I would fall in love, something wouldn't work out, and I'd write a song about it. Most of my early songwriting is all about the women where things didn't work out with them, and I was inspired to write music about them. And it would all just come out of me, the melody, the lyrics, the licks, the hooks, the bridges, it really all, it happened so quickly. And that's how I've always written music, even about my wife. Things almost didn't work out with us. And I wrote a whole album of music about her. And I was in my almost 40 years old by that point. I've always been that type of a songwriter. And writing a book is nothing like that. Writing a book is about putting your butt in the chair and writing. And then sending it off to your editor and her telling you, do it all over again. And having to take in that feedback and feel a lot of despair and humiliation and anger and resentment. Well, you think you have such an amazing idea and the person holds it up to you and they're like, this is not right. Do it again and try it this way. And then maybe after a couple of drafts, you get there. And that's the most incredible feeling, to be able to like take in that feedback, to really just have to, unfortunately, soak in the failure at writing something that you thought was so great and then trying again. That's writing, you know? So it's not unlike learning the banjo, actually. It's not unlike learning an instrument, writing in the sense that like it's about discipline and getting up and dusting yourself off when it doesn't work and getting back to it. If you love it so much, you just have to put in the time, you know? So it's really, you know, so I would say that my writing is not influenced by being a songwriter at all or a musician, but it's influenced by, I guess, my ability to have some discipline, you know? So.
I think you're right. There's a certain amount of discipline that it takes being a songwriter and also being a novel writer or an autobiographical writer or a nonfiction writer. So, but you know, you were mentioning that you write a song about, let's say, a breakup of a relationship or another challenge in your life. Some of the best music I've listened to that's helped me through my own challenges have been songwriters who have poured their heart and soul into a song, who have been tortured souls for either for a period of time or during the breakup of a relationship, and just pour some just really just meaningful, deep the music that's not only musically sound, but lyrically is just profound.
Yeah. And you know what? Music, like the combination of the lyrics and the melody, this is apropos of what you just said. They're almost like this time capsule, this receptacle, and it holds the energy of the moment somehow. Yeah. And like for me personally, like some songs that I've written about some of the women in my life, if I listen to it, I don't know what it is. It's something in the olfactory. It's almost like smelling something and it brings you back to a kitchen. It brings me right back to being right in the middle of it somehow. I don't know why. I don't know why music does that. But it does for me, and it just makes me grateful that I wrote the songs and I recorded them, because it really allows me to kind of have my own legacy for my work. Also, I wanted to say that what you're mentioning, you made me think of, if you haven't watched it yet, watch the Billy Joel documentary. It just came out on HBO. Have you seen it? Do you watch TV at all?
I do watch TV when I can, but I've heard of the Billy Joel documentary. I've heard it's fabulous, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
He was such a biographical songwriter.
Yep.
And it really, regardless of how you think of him as a person or a personality, like the craft of the songwriting and how like the songwriting really represents what he would go through in his life at the time, then he write the music. It was really interesting. And I actually really identify with it because I was a lot like him. I really wrote something on the nose as it was happening to me. And it comes out in a way that where it's like, it's who you are. It's authentic to yourself. You don't necessarily like somebody might not hear a Matt Check song and be like, I can see it's exactly about this situation, right? It might be a little bit of esoteric lyric here and there, but it is true to myself. And that's always how I've been as a creative, as a songwriter, at least, just comes right out of me. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the truer you are to yourself with anything, whether you're writing a book, whether you're writing a song, the more impactful it becomes. In some ways, that helps us find our genuine selves as well. It's information that we can use to grow. And I know music, particularly the music of Tom Petty, the Wallflowers, the Counting Crows, those bands, they were emotionally cathartic. And it helped me also put some perspective on, you know, some of the worst tragedies of my life. So,
yeah.
I believe
you mentioned Adam Duritz last time, right?
Yeah.
Did you bring him up?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I did. You know, he had his own challenges, I know, with addiction, and he had his own challenges with mental health. And it's well documented in terms of what he went through. And he's just writing now some of the best music of his life. But his experiences have fueled his songwriting. And you just, when you hear him, you can feel the pain in his voice. You can feel the catharsis. It's a reflection of the pain in those lyrics in terms of how he did his vocals, which makes his music very appealing to me.
Yeah, I can identify with that.
Yeah. So for me, I think the creative arts are really great in terms of helping individuals work through challenge, regardless of what those creative arts are, whether it's music, whether it's art, whether it's painting, whether it's photography. I think it can help us find peace.
Yes.
Matt, one of my last questions for you today, and you've left us with a lot so far, but if there's one thing, one ultimate wisdom that you want to leave our listeners with today? What would that be? And I would qualify this by saying there could be subcategories.
Well, I mean, I think that what's one thing I want to leave with you. It's really hard to be authentic. My experience in life, I'm 44 and a half, is that I always feel like I've gotten to a place of authenticity, and I find out I'm being a little bit fake, unfortunately. Like, I thought I was really self-aware when I was younger, and then I found that I was an alcoholic. Right? And then in sobriety, I thought, I really got this figured out. I'm going to finally get a girlfriend and a wife, you know? And then I found out that I loved the woman that was going to become my life, but I needed to figure out how to be a good partner. And then I needed to figure out, you know, like, oh, if I'm figuring this part of my life out, and I really need to be a good colleague at work. I've worked many years. I've had many jobs. Like, this next job that I'm getting, like, it's all going to be fine. And I find out that, you know, wow, you've still got to figure a couple things out with, like, having relationships with work colleagues. So I find that really being yourself and stepping into your greatness and being the best person you can be never stops being part of, I guess, the journey of your life, unfortunately, or fortunately. Maybe it's always about learning. Maybe it's always about not really knowing yourself 100%, right? And so it's a lesson that's really tough for me. I really credit my wife, who really shows me who I am, for better or for worse. I remember hearing about being married before I was married, and I'm like, I'm never going to be married. I don't want to be married. I don't want to be with anybody. I want to be single. I want to travel the world. I have a girlfriend here and there. And, you know, and here I am, happily married most of the time. I love her very much. And I really can't believe that it's actually true that, like, most of her ideas are 95% of the right. 95% of the time, she's usually right. And whenever I have a bad idea and she tells me that's a bad idea, she's right. And another thing about my wife that this is about being, this is to the idea about being authentic, that being authentic is hard. One of the biggest fears about getting married, by the way, which, like, I was really afraid to be in a serious relationship because I was afraid she was going to take me away from being the Matt Check I always saw myself as, the musician, the artist, the traveler, the this, the that, you know what? And she has helped me actually step into that greatness more than I ever could by myself. She's allowed me to pursue the life that I always wanted to pursue just by her, like, her energy. You know what I mean? And that, like, that's an amazing thing. That really is. I have to credit her with a lot of the successes in my life. I mean, sure, we get frustrated with each other, but that being said, I guess, you know, one thing comes with the other, I suppose. But she's really helped me kind of understand that, like, wow, I just don't see myself for who I am all the time still, you know, and I really, you know, the ideal for me is to really to continue to achieve to be authentic in my life, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and I think achievement to be authentic is something we should all strive for. And I'm a firm believer, and I've said this on other podcasts, I've said this on mine, authenticity doesn't mean that. It's about all about happiness. It's all about the parts of ourselves that aren't happy that allow us to be authentic, that we can embrace those parts that we've had to look at, whether it be our challenges with substance use, whether it be challenges with relationships, whether it be things that kind of reminded us that it's not all about being happy, but it's about embracing the sadness, it's about embracing the ambiguity and learning from that. And by the way, congratulations on what, 2 years now of sobriety?
Well, sobriety is 11 years.
11 years, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're married 2 years as of today.
Yeah. But congratulations on 11 years of sobriety and two years of marriage. And I've been happily married for 43 years, and I can tell you I've been right 54 times in 43 years of marriage, and I got every one of them counted. The other thing, man, I'm going to give you a little bit of sage advice from somebody who's been married 41 years longer.
Okay.
There's this exercise that I read somewhere that, do this with your spouse.
Okay.
Ever write down the 6 things that she does not, that she, about you, that she does not like or want you to improve. I did that with my wife. And right now, I think she's still coming up for air. She's still writing. I love my wife. But, you know, it's just, I mean, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And she supports what I do. We have different interests, but, you know, she supports me being who I am. I support her being who we are together. That individuality within the relationship makes us better as a couple. So, but my last question for you, it's going to give you the opportunity to promote yourself a little bit, promote the book. If listeners want to contact you, find out more about what you're doing as far as your book tour, purchase the book. What's the best way for them to do that, Matt?
I have a website. It's MatthewCheckMusic.com. You can buy the book there. There's a bunch of links to all the different stores, online stores. All my links for Instagram and Facebook are on my website as well. And my music, Apple, Spotify, Pandora, whatever you listen to. And if you're a music lover, my book is a music memoir, even though it's about other things. On my YouTube page, there's a YouTube playlist of songs that I talk about in the book. Not just my music, but songs that you might recognize from out there. Some might be some prizes, some might be some fun. It's not just bluegrass music. So it's fun putting that YouTube playlist together. So maybe you'll check that out. And I do have a couple of book events coming up after my launch, one in Jacksonville, Florida, one in Brooklyn, one in Champaign, Illinois. Where else am I doing it? One in Indianapolis. You can check it out on my website for those dates. If you're in those cities, you want to come by and buy a book and say hi. I want to thank you, David, for having me on the podcast. I listened through a couple of your episodes. You have some really amazing people come through your Rolodex. So thank you for being out there doing this for people.
Well, and also I have to thank Noemi Barris, one of the premier podcast agents around, for introducing us. And she always has a great sense of who would make a great guest contributor to the podcast. And she has not missed. So it's like I told you during the introduction, it's like, when she recommends somebody, it's not the question of whether you're a good fit for me. It's whether I'm a good fit for you as a host. And I'm glad we were able to make this happen because I truly enjoyed our conversation today, Matt.
Likewise, David. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.